hit it.
And welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm so excited that you're joining us today. We are going to have a fascinating conversation, as usual, as we learn from people all around the world at all ages and stages of life. Stay tuned as we shift our dementia care from crisis to comfort.
All right, here we go. What you think about?
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm thrilled that you're going to be joining us today. We're going to have a really interesting conversation on how your spare change can really make a difference in the world of dementia. But before I introduce our guest, I always like to first do a few shout-outs. So one is to the Mark Arneson Band, who did our opening song called Clarion Call. If you like that, you can go ahead and download that on any of your music platforms. Also, this is a live show, so you can go ahead and call in with any questions or comments at 323-870-4602. That's 323-870-4602. So let me see. I am going to give a shout out to Artist Senior Living. In fact, I'm going to be doing a program for them this evening, which is 6:30 Eastern. That would be 5:30 Central, 4:30 Mountain Time, and 3:30 Pacific Time. And it's going to be a virtual program, which is free, on conscious, compassionate care for care partners. And you can register for that by going to theartistway.com/care. We'd love to see you there. Also, I want to give a couple of shout outs to some caregiver groups that I am facilitating. One is Arthur's Memory Cafe. We get together the second and the fourth Wednesday at 1 p.m. Central Time. That is virtual, and anybody is welcome to join that. Also, with Brookdale Senior Living in North Oaks and the Shoreview Community Center, we have a caregiver support group that meets in person the last Wednesday of each month from 10 to 11. And you can just reach out to me at radio@AlzheimerSpeaks to learn more about both of those. Also, the Brain Donor Project is looking for your brain or brains of others. They can be healthy brains or not, but they need brains to be able to assess in order to help us find a cure. So please check that out. And then I want to give a shout out also to the dementia research charity BRACE, because they're having a global conference called Together for Dementia November 2nd, and we would love for you to join us at that conference as well. There's more information on alzheimerspeaks.com on that. And then, of course, I have to give a shout out to Dementia Map, our global resource directory, which is growing every day. It's perfect for people with dementia, care partners, as well as business professionals and advocates. It's free to use. You don't have to give us any information to access information. And if you have a resource, product, or tool, we would love to have you be part of the directory as well. On there, you'll find things like the Memory Cafe directory, Coral Health, who is still allowing people to download two of their apps free, and the Footbar Walker, which we're going to hear from next, and then we'll be back with our guest. So hold on tight.
Introducing the life-changing Footbar Walker.
I'm Peggy from Danville, Kentucky, and I'm 91 years old. The Footbar Walker revolutionized my care of George. The saving that I made from having to put him in a nursing home came to about $192,000. The foot bar walker opens and closes just like a standard walker. The only thing that is different is the top bar and the foot bar. Does that ever make a difference?
Does someone you love use a walker? Do they struggle to get up from a seated position? Are you a caregiver dealing with physical pain and stress as you help your patient? The foot bar walker was designed to assist not only the patient, but also the caregiver. Patients have more control standing up, and no lifting from the caregiver is required. See how it works at thefootbarwalker.com. That's thefootbarwalker.com. Peggy, would you recommend the foot bar walker?
Do I ever? I would not be in the health that I'm in today at this age had it not been for the foot bar walker.
Well, we are back, and I can't wait to introduce you to our guest today. We are going to be talking with Max Turkowski, who is a serial nonprofit and social enterprise entrepreneur. And he is the founder and CEO of Investicure, a public benefit corporation building a community of spare change investors and R&D companies working together to help end Alzheimer's. So this is going to be a really fascinating conversation. And again, remember, you can call in with your questions or comments because we are live today, and that number is 323-870-4602. That's 323-870-4602. So welcome, Max. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Lori. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm excited to have this conversation and to spread the word of your work. But before we dive in, like I always do, I'm always interested to find out if you have been personally touched by dementia in your own family or circle of friends.
Certainly. You know, who hasn't? I've seen... close friends, their parents hit by Alzheimer's, people who have accomplished so much in their lives. There's an artist that was very close with Mark Leonsky, a painter, a brilliant man who was just, to see a living genius sink into Alzheimer's. Lose his memory, lose his ability to function. It was just absolutely heartbreaking. And this is probably the scariest thing that could ever happen to a person of intellect, losing our capacity and to use our minds, to remember, to function, and become dependent on others. It's a tremendous horror that's hard to describe.
I agree. It is it's hard to believe anybody out there hasn't been touched, and the numbers are only growing. Let's talk about Investicure. What exactly is it, and what made you decide to launch it?
Thank you. Interestingly, Investicure did not start out with Alzheimer's. It started with a discovery that I made as we were battling my daughter's cancer. My daughter was diagnosed with osteosarcoma when she was 12, and in fact, she recently passed away this year after a 7-year battle with osteosarcoma. But in the midst of that journey, there was a drug that she needed. And we were in the best cancer hospital in the world in Sloan Kettering. And the lead scientist on the drug was our very own oncologist. And the data was incredible. It reduced recurrence by 50%. And what we learned was that we could not receive the drug because a small company that was doing clinical trials for the drug could not raise enough capital to go through with the final clinical trial. You know, the data was there that the drug could be incredibly effective, but it was a financial decision. by a small drug company. And, you know, prior to that, I thought that drugs and potential medical interventions, right, were developed, funded by, you know, by the National Cancer Institute, by, you know, in fact, Sloan Kettering, right, is one of the biggest nonprofit cancer labs in the world. So if a drug is that good, why can't Sloan Kettering do the clinical trial? Like, you know, what is this, how did this tiny company, right, fit into the mix? And what about the big pharmaceuticals? And as I began to study the process of drug development, something astounding became apparent, right? When it comes to ideas, when it comes to what they call in the scientific realm basic research, right? Something you would read in a magazine article about the next miracle cure for cancer or for Alzheimer's, that's funded by the government, by charities. It's called basic research. But when an idea is developed, we rely on drug companies to take that idea, to license it and to do clinical trials, and in fact, even before clinical trials, to synthesize the actual drug, to begin animal trials, and begin the very long journey of developing an actual intervention. And that's not done by nonprofits typically. That is mainly done by drug companies. And unless some drug company believes that they could make money from it, right, the most brilliant ideas, the most brilliant discoveries that could save millions of lives are left on the drawing boards. And hence, so many of the news headlines that we read about revolutionary new therapy never come to light. I never developed because they are stopped midway through. So I thought about this and says, what an interesting thing. When it comes to, you know, my background is in the nonprofit industry, right? It's in educational nonprofits. And, you know, I'm very used to the appeal to the heart. And, you know, you have charities that are reaching out for a donation, right? And that donation typically goes to some university lab, and the idea that would be developed by that lab would hit a brick wall, because suddenly in the next process, we rely on Wall Street, we rely on investors to take it to the next step, right? Nobody's raising donations for those companies, and in fact, as I began to study the pharmaceutical industry, it became very alarming, because sometimes pharmaceutical companies even buy patents on drugs, not to develop them, but sometimes they buy those patents because they make conflict with the other drugs they already have if the new drug is better. The process that's driven purely by money, purely by the profit motive, right, is deeply flawed. And I thought about this, and a brilliant idea came to mind. That time, there was a company called Acorns that was taking the world by storm, which was the idea of spear change investment, targeting millennials mainly who didn't have money at the end of the month. And the idea was, invest your, if you think you have no money, right, wouldn't it be reasonable to just invest your spare change from transaction roundups, meaning every time you buy a coffee for Starbucks for $4.80, right, everybody could afford to put away that 20 cents, the roundup to the nearest dollar, right? And calculation is made, the piece of software makes that calculation, the roundups, and puts that in a savings account, in an investment account. And the company became, you know, the Acorns proved that spear change investment is something could be very popular. And I said to myself, well, what if we take the same idea, invest your spear change in a group of companies, but instead of the profit motive, what if we turn to the millions of people impacted by disease and say, hey, let's buy stock in these small pharmaceutical companies that are doing early stage R&D, right, that are developing these brilliant projects, and we give them the capital to develop the projects, and in return, we own those companies, right? The spare change investors actually own shares in the companies. So if you can get hundreds of thousands, millions of people to invest based on their desire to see a disease cured, then you could achieve public ownership of drug companies where each individual person is investing just a small amount. So it's not the money we need for our future, not the money we need for our retirement funding. It's just our spare change. But collectively, we would be investing quite a large amount of money, right? Acorns got to 1 million users in just about a year and a half after launch. If we take a large disease like Alzheimer's, 70 million Americans have a relative with Alzheimer's, very large affinity group. We have the collective power, if just 2% of the affinity group become spare change investors, 2 million spare change investors, that's $1 billion a year in annual investment in the space. That is 13 times more than the current level of venture capital that's going into the space. And what it would achieve is collective ownership of drug companies, right? By shareholders for whom the priority isn't making a profit because, hey, they're just investing their spare change. But the priority is moving vital projects forward. And that is how the idea of InvestiCure was born. And, as we began to speak to scientists, leading scientists in the space, it resonated. Every scientist we spoke to joined our board, quite an esteemed board, told us that, wow, when it comes to a grant for your university from the NIH, that's easy. But if you have a real idea that could change the world, that could cure a disease, getting a pharmaceutical company to back it and raising money for that, that's nearly impossible. And we spoke to finance people at MIT who have been studying this trend in the pharmaceutical industry. This is actually part of a global trend in the pharmaceutical industry going back to 1950. Every 9 years, the risk of developing, the cost of developing a single drug per $1 billion spent actually doubles, right? So it costs 50 times more in investment to develop a single drug today than in 1950. And what that means is that pharmaceutical companies and investors are very reluctant to back innovative projects, right? Because there's a high amount of risk involved, right? If I told you, you can make an investment and there is a 1 in 50 chance that it will make you very rich, but 49 in 50 chance that it won't come to anything, it's a bad investment. But if I tell you you can invest in projects that have the best possible chance to improve our chances of finding a cure for Alzheimer's, every single project adds data, right? Gives us more information and brings us one step closer to a cure. That is a good deal. So that was kind of the idea behind InvestiCure and our journey with it.
Well, I appreciate all that. I have so many comments. First, I want to say I'm sorry for the loss of your daughter. I can't imagine how difficult that is and how frustrating that was when you knew that there was a medication that could possibly have helped, but you just couldn't get it out there. And you know, I think what you're doing is such an honor in terms of trying to change that for many, many families. I find this a really interesting concept on multiple levels. And one I want to ask you about is the new Biogen drug. But I first want to get to a couple of the questions first and comments is, you know, some listeners might be saying, well, who gets to decide what projects, you know, we're going to fund on this? And how is the control really handled? I think most people are going to spot right off that the CEOs of these pharmaceuticals aren't probably going to be making the big bonuses that some of these really large groups make. But I could be mistaken there. But I know that that's something that people wonder about. Is there control over that factor? And again, how are projects picked?
So in terms of how projects are picked, you know, they would be picked by the leading scientists with the help of leading scientists in a space within, you know, vetted by accountants and investment experts. Our chief investment officer has 40 years of experience in the pharmaceutical industry investment. Our scientists are some of the leading names in the space, right? The truth is that you need professionals picking the projects. And ideally, what you want to do is you want to back a diverse range of projects. You know, from the every scientist out there with an innovative project believes that there's only one problem in the world, right? It's not a lack of money. It's the fact that their project wasn't chosen for investment, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, they're convinced that it's the best project in the world. The truth is that we don't know, right? We don't know who's right. We don't know who's wrong. Science relies on trial and error. Science relies on developing each hypothesis, testing it for clinical trials, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, and adding in a transparent way to our knowledge of the disease. It's like solving a puzzle, right? The more projects move forward for clinical trials, right, the more information we add to our body of knowledge and the closer we are to solving the puzzle. So in terms of who's making those decisions, it's real scientists, you know, the best in the space, allowing funding for every viable solution that needs to be developed and tested. In terms of the dynamics of the pharmaceutical industry, it's very interesting because when we talk about these drug companies, right, we are really not talking about big pharma. Big pharma comes in these days much later in a project. What happened was that due to the cost, the high cost of early stage R&D, big pharma since the past 10 years has decided that they make a lot more money backing a project once it passes phase two of clinical trials. Once a particular approach has proved to be effective, and they have greatly cut down on early stage R&D. The types of companies that are out there that are taking projects from academia and moving them forward tend to be, you know, scientists who are frustrated by the fact that their ideas are not being developed and have taken the brave step of starting a company and trying to raise money for investors for clinical trials and moving the project forward. So because that's just the way those types of projects get done. And most spend 10, 20 years just trying to raise money to move the project to the next level. It is an incredibly inefficient project. Our idea is to now take that investment pitch from Wall Street, right, to the people impacted by disease on the merits, on the scientific merits of whether or not a project should be based. And the main reason why we distrust, one of the most important things for us to remember, drug companies are owned by shareholders. A company is an entity that is owned by the people who own the stock. If a stock in a drug company is owned by hedge funds, by Wall Street, their primary responsibility, right, to the pension funds that invest in them is to make money. And hence, decisions will be made based on that point of reference. If drug companies are owned by a community comprising of millions of people who are investing just a small amount, where the amount that they are investing is so small that for them, the main drive for investing is to develop a solution, then we achieve something remarkable. We achieve a public ownership of those drug companies where collectively we could set the rules of how of how the game is played. This is something that's a remarkable opportunity for a disease space that could be achieved through equity ownership, of drug companies by an affinity group that is deeply committed to curing a disease.
Well, and I can see how that can drive the outcomes very, very differently. And, you know, I think myself, you know, I take my change and I throw it in a pot, and every now and then I'll go to the bank and get it back. And, you know, it's nice to get that extra $100, you know, after you've saved some change up. But, it's not like I needed it or missed it for the most part. And I think there's a lot of people out there like me, doing that. And if I could make a difference in this space, that I'm definitely passionate about, that has affected my family and many, many dear friends as well, I just think that would be such a better use. And I was kind of flabbergasted at the number of members that you said Acorn had gotten in a year, a million people. You think you just multiply that by, just a few people and, a few hundred dollars, even if that's what their change difference is, and it's probably much more than that, I can see where that can add up really, really quickly and be empowering and cutting to the chase. I think one of the frustrating things for anybody with an idea is how do you fund it, and to really be focused. And this is going to kind of roll into the whole Biogen piece. You had said it'll be, the decision makers will be the experts. How do we know something like that happened with the Biogen where the experts didn't agree, but it still got approved? Do you have any stop holds for that, or is it easier to control in this fashion?
I just want to, before I get to that question, I just want to make it clear that when we talk about fair change investment, we're talking about digital spare change. We're not talking about going to people's homes and getting mm-hmm. the actual physical coins. The app works, the investment platforms works very simply. You connect your credit card, you connect your bank account. The system calculates your roundups automatically to the nearest dollar, and every time that hits $5, it simply makes an ACH transfer from your bank account. The system is very rudimentary. It's fair change is an idea, right? It's a social contract where we can all agree that investing that roundup, right, is not a big deal. It feels painless at the time. So, mm-hmm. but nobody's going around to people's houses collecting spare change. That would be quite odious and not very efficient. But getting back to Biogen, this is a very interesting point, right? With Biogen, the FDA faced a real dilemma. And I believe the reason they faced this dilemma is a clear illustration of the problem we face, right? Biogen's drug was the first serious contender in 18 years to pass phase 3 clinical trials. Now, currently, there are at least 300 different projects crawling slowly, raising money, right, for clinical trials or for animal trials, in a process where instead of actually doing those trials, everybody is just running around raising money for 10, 15 years. Hence, what reaches the FDA desk in the Alzheimer's space that passes all the hurdles is just one drug. And that drug is very problematic, right? On one hand, you have a community that's desperately waiting for something. On the other hand, you have a single horse reaching the finish line. It's like, imagine you have a horse race, and just one horse, right? You know, all the other horses are stuck at the start line, and one horse makes it, right? It's not a contest, mm-hmm. right? Who do you declare the winner, right? If you have nothing to choose from. And the reason you have nothing to choose from is because of the slow pace of progress for all the other projects, not because the projects aren't there, not because there aren't brilliant ideas that could be a solution, but because most of these brilliant ideas are just simply stuck. And once you get something that approaches the finish line, people tend to bend their logic, their hope to produce something begins to skew their rational thought process. And hence you have this controversy. Is it good? Is it not good? Right? Many, many pros and cons. I'm not going to comment on the science. This is one of the most controversial topics ever. And it's hotly debated by the scientific community, and it seems that the data for the drug is quite weak. But you know, with the only drug that the FDA had on their table in 19 years, it's very hard for them to deflect that pressure to approve the drug. You know, mm-hmm. the real problem we should be solving is. Next year there should be 20 drugs coming up for phase 3 approval, right? Then you can comment and say that, you know, of the 20 drugs, this is the best and it should never be approved, right? The real issue is that there's just one drug reaching the finish line. That is a symptom of a very problematic process, and that's mm-hmm. what we're trying to solve.
Okay, and I agree. I definitely agree on that, and it has been very interesting to watch. I know just with all of the, you know, between the virus and the CDC and now the conflict with the FDA, I mean, I know the public is just getting weary with what is the process and are we following rules? Is there rules? You know, is this in the public's best interest? All of those things are coming into play kind of large and clear, I think, in just about any area you can think of these days. And so I find this interesting, basically with InvestiCure to rally the forces together, to invest. What do you think it's going to take to find a cure? Do you have a time frame at all? I know for the last, I've been in the space since 2009, and everyone's, you know, every 5 years there's going to be a cure. That's what I keep hearing, and still we're not close. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that anybody who says there's going to be a cure in 5 years, I really don't get their understanding of the industry, right? But for that to happen, you would need to have projects that are reaching phase three, the end of phase three clinical trials. Currently, the journey for any project is between raising investment and then executing on clinical trials. It takes 20 years for a single project to move forward. And frankly, we don't know whether we already have a cure, right? It's one of the projects that didn't even make it to the starting line because nobody licensed it, right? In order for us to solve a puzzle, right? You need to have, if you're trying to solve a Rubik's Cube, right? You can't do it if you're limited to three turns, right? Every month, right? It's going to take you a very long time.
Sure.
If you can make, if you're solving a Rubik's Cube, right? And you're going to, and you could make 100 turns a minute, right? You're going to solve it in 2-3 minutes, right? But if you can't, if you're handicapped, right, who knows? It could take forever, right? But the one thing, I'm not a prophet. I don't, and I'm not a betting man, right? We simply don't know. What we do know is that our job is to make sure that every viable solution gets tested, adds to our body of knowledge and what we know about the disease, whether it fails or succeeds, right? The data from those tests should be shared publicly, and that is another innovation that would be possible if the companies are owned by the public. Frankly, the shareholders call the shots, right? If the in the current environment, one of the saddest things is that because investors are so hyper focused on safeguarding the financial value of their investment, they treat clinical trial data as a business secret, right? But if the same investors own all the companies in the space, and if they primarily care about finding a solution to a disease, we can actually mandate that clinical trial data be shared by the entire community, right? And the way we are able to solve a disease, right? That would be a complete game changer. And we don't know how long it will take. All we know is that if we speed up the process, we have a good chance of solving it in the fastest possible way, maybe even in time, to help our loved ones.
Well, that's good. That's good. And I understand why you don't want to try to pin down a cure. I think that also gets old for those of us that are waiting for one. What are the next steps for InvestiCure? What's your roadmap for the next couple of years here with the program?
Well, currently. What we built is an investment platform, which is quite complicated. We had to get through all the legal processes and build a structure for it and build a supportive scientific base, right? And right now we are currently, our next step is to raise money to complete and launch the program and execute on a 3-year plan to reach 2% of the affinity group and generate $1 billion a year in annual investment for Alzheimer's. To do that, our first step is to complete our complete the platform and begin to market it. For that, we need supporters and investors. We're also right now developing an interesting internal blockchain component with the Akuro token, which is something that's very interesting that will help once the community is created of companies and participants, right? It will allow them to collaborate by participating, you know, rewarding participation in clinical trials and sharing of vital healthcare data that helps scientists and researchers, advance projects, which is a very interesting idea in and of itself. But right now what we need are supporters and backers, and to educate the public about the idea and to build this platform as quickly as possible.
Okay. How do our listeners get involved, you know, with InvestiCare? What would their next steps be if they wanted to get involved?
We would love to hear from them, right? Our email is listed. You could reach out to me personally if you're interested in getting involved as a supporter, as an investor, or you have ideas for the project. I'm here to listen. My email is mtokarski@investicure.com, and I believe my cell phone is listed as well. We are working on this nonstop because the sooner we get this launched and built, the quicker we can actually make a difference in the space.
Wonderful. So contact information is listed on the radio page, on the blog. So wherever you are, you can find that. But again, I'll just repeat that website is investacure.com. And Max's email is mtokarsky@investacure.com. And his phone number is 718-812-0779. Well, Max, this has been a really interesting conversation, and I wish you nothing but the best. I would love to see this really come to life, so I appreciate you taking time. Is there anything that we didn't cover that we should before I let you go?
I think we've covered quite a bit.
Wonderful. I think we covered a lot as well. And again, thank you, listeners, and thank you, Max, for your time and your efforts and your creativity of trying to bring something new that matters to the arena of dementia. If you need to reach me, you can email me at radio@alzheimerspeaks.com, or you can go directly to alzheimerspeaks.com, our website. I'm looking forward to our new launch as well, which is probably still another month out. Oh my gosh, it just takes forever pulling those websites together. But we are working on it, people. So, keep coming to me with your ideas. If you want to be on the show, we're always looking for guests. So I would love to talk with you and share what you're doing. In the meantime, everybody have a blessed week, and we will be back again on Thursday. Thank you so much. And Max, thank you again.
Thank you so much, Lori, and thank you to all the listeners.
Bye now.
Hi, everyone. This is Meredith from the Senior Fitness with Meredith podcast, where I discuss all things for seniors, from fitness, your health and wellness journeys, how to be all over strong and beyond. I also have my mini podcast called Motivation with Meredith. It's a great, quick, motivational pick-me-up for your days. Join me. Listen now. Search for Senior Fitness with Meredith on your favorite podcast platform.